And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Chris Cooling, a film professor at the College of Lake County. Chris has been teaching film classes at CLC since 2008. He has also curated a public series of recent international films since 2009. He received his PhD from the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts in 2006 and is here today to discuss the Oscar nominations. And Chris, it's great to see you again. Welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. You know, I was driving up here and I was thinking about all the various films nominated and how excited and how worked up I was. And I realized that your soothing radio voice would calm me down, you would introduce the show, and I would relax. Sometimes I get worked up. I'm getting passionate about some of these, just thinking about them. But I'm glad that you're here to give me some grounding.
Well, I tell you what, there's a lot to be passionate for. I just think this is a wonderful crop of films, and we're going to look at the Best Picture here in just a moment. In fact, the last time you were here, we talked about Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
And Gone Girl, and interestingly enough, they're not on the radar for the top eight Best Picture nominees. So why don't we look at them? We'll get to it right away right now.
Okay. And I do want to come back to Gone Girl, though. I'm surprised it's not one of them.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, boy, it seems to get sidetracked, which is fine. Let's plan on getting sidetracked.
Well, now that the nominations for Best Picture are so plentiful that they've gone beyond five, it is meant to be kind of a cornucopia. You know, you could go in many directions, and sometimes they could go up to 10, and you think to yourself, if you could, why leave out Gone Girl, which was so popular, which people talked about, which would help people watch the show? Anytime you've got a movie that's good and popular and talked about, controversial in any capacity, that can only help the Oscars to get ratings, which is a big part of what the game is about.
Plus, 8 is such an odd number anyway. Why not just go to 10? And for example, why not also, as long as we're going that route with popularity, Guardians of the Galaxy, I mean, so many people were into it. And like you said, that would just increase the audience numbers on Sunday night when the Oscars are going to be.
That was the famous example, is that a lot of people thought that The Dark Knight, the Christopher Nolan Batman film, should have been one of the five. And the Oscars, the Academy said, next year we'll expand it to beyond five, precisely so that we can include things like that. You know, I think in some ways, to me, The Theory of Everything and The Imitation Game are a bit redundant, both being there. I understand that they're both good, but The Theory of Everything I didn't get to because I felt like I'd already seen it with The Imitation Game. I'd seen a British period piece about a troubled, brilliant man. And I just say, I can't get to this. I'm sure it's nice that there's room for that, but the more variety, the better. And Gone
Girl, Chris, whether
different.
You like it or not, we're going to get to both of those today.
Right. I'm a betting man. The Oscars is about gambling, and I'm betting we don't get further than American Sniper. That's the rest.
Well,
of the
I tell you what. Instead of calling it predictions, we'll call it suggestions.
Sure.
And let's take a look though at the eight films that are nominated for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And I'll just list them to begin with: American Sniper, which you just mentioned. Birdman, Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, and Whiplash. And let's begin with American Sniper. And interesting, too, we've talked about this before on the program. Of the eight nominees this year for Best Picture, four of them focus on real-life characters, which we found that to be really in the last couple of years. But let's begin with American Sniper, the Clint Eastwood biopic about Navy SEAL Chris Kyle, the deadliest gunman in military history. The film has been a huge success at the box office.
$400 million worldwide.
Unbelievable. And has been labeled both as an anti-war movie and a pro-war movie at the same time. Your observations about the film American Sniper, starring Bradley Cooper, in a wonderful performance, I might add. Okay, go ahead. What do you think?
Well, it's funny. We were talking earlier, and you'd mentioned that you found the trailers so specific and interesting, particularly strong. And I agree with you. I thought that it looked really good. It was getting the Oscar attention and the critical attention. And it's made by Clint Eastwood, who has made many really good, complex, thoughtful movies about this sort of subject matter. Unforgiven is about masculinity, violence, America. And then in particular, I'm thinking of the the couplet he made, Flags for Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, very pointedly devoting an entire movie to both sides of the story. And I found myself a bit disappointed when I saw American Sniper, that I felt I felt like Clint Eastwood's reputation and the advertising, those great trailers, sold me a more complicated film than I got. I think that there are ways in which it is complicated, but it's not maybe complicated enough. And I think that structurally, fundamentally, it's a little bit simple in terms of celebrating one great man. You know, a lot of movies
it
will
does
do
get
that.
Into the issues, though, of post-traumatic stress.
Yeah,
and,
they're there.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Well, this is why I need your radio voice to calm me down. I get worked up because I'm worked up. It does. But think about this. This is a movie where Chris Kyle had become celebrated. You know, he was notorious. He was a celebrity even during his wartime. And then he publishes his memoir, one of two books that he writes about these experiences. And then they start making a film about them. And we should say, I guess we're going to spoil the ending, but then again, the news has already spoiled it.
Right? I was just looking at it on the internet today.
Yeah,
go ahead.
The trial of the man who killed Chris Kyle is about to start in Texas. So it's not really a spoiler. It's ripped from the headlines.
Right, in Stephenville, Texas, yeah. Eddie Ruth, for the killing of Chris Kyle and his friend Chad Littlefield.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the movie was being made, the movie was being scripted, the book was being adapted before this happened.
Right, 2 years ago.
Right. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the movie had to kind of catch up and adjust to the fact that Chris Kyle had died.
Right.
And so I'm left thinking, well, what would have been the ending and what would have been the overall point if he was still alive?
Wow.
You know, and Zero Dark Thirty had the same issue a few years ago. Mm-hmm. They made that movie before we caught before Osama bin Laden was caught and killed. And I thought to myself, well, what would the point of the movie, the message, the meaning have been if the chase just went on and on and on? That would have been a movie more like Zodiac, about obsession and the damage that obsession can do. And I felt like the way in which this movie addressed his death was very abrupt. It was very quick. And then we end on a very, very long celebratory funeral, suggesting he was really, really great, and ignore the fact that he was killed by another military man who didn't recover from PTSD quickly enough. And that's a very strong central irony that, to me, is an irony worthy of those other great Clint Eastwood movies that this one wasn't directly addressing as fully. It's there, of course, but the fact that we are making this man a hero, I think is troubling because it's so satisfying. It's such a formula. It's Oscars have loved this. Great man, struggle, a great man in an important place of history. But the fact that we're trying to historicize the present in American Sniper is catching it up a little bit. The present is rewriting the movie to a degree that won't let Clint Eastwood celebrate him as much as we might like. And it left me feeling like the movie should have spent more time about this man who killed him, and the irony that some people don't recover. Some people do, some people don't. And in general, they're not getting as much treatment as they should. And what would the film have said about that if he hadn't died?
Well, I don't know. Is that really the point? Because I think, you know, the biopics, that's one of the problems. Whether it's Selma or any of these, we end up looking at the historical facts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is cinema.
Yes.
And we're talking about the Oscars.
Yes.
And when I went to that movie, I didn't realize it would be edge of the seat, riveting, much in the experience I had with Hurt Locker, for example, where I got into that world. And, you know, I was not at the Vernon Hills Theater. I was actually in Iraq. I mean, you get into that world.
Right.
And isn't cinema for that 2 hours supposed to let you go into that world on that magic screen? And you become part of whoever, with those characters, the family, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was taking a film class years ago, the screenplay, to write a screenplay, they would say that the key to it was, and then what happens?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
what happens? And then what happens? This was a screenplay writing class. And that's what's happening in this film. I think regardless of what's going on outside there in the media and what happened to him,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you can go into that film either way, knowing whether you know the outcome or don't know the outcome, it's edge of the seat.
It's not a poorly made film.
Oh, no.
It's not a dull film.
No, not at all.
But
edge of your seat.
You yourself framed this discussion of these Oscar-nominated films saying, these four are based on real things and these ones aren't. And then you just said, but isn't cinema supposed to transport you and put you somewhere? Cinema is allowed to do whatever it wants. And that's the problem. Cinema can do, transporting you is one of many great things cinema can do, but waking you up to the world around you and engaging you in a conversation with it is another. And
right,
you mentioned Selma. Selma, to me, is not a biopic. Selma is a great movie that features Martin Luther King as a central character. But it is a great movie about process. And for me, Selma was a more contemporary version of Lincoln, which was watch how this politician goes through the process and works with other people. And it's not about hagiography. We already know. It's redundant. We know he's a great man and a great orator and a great speaker. And of course, we're not going to ignore that when we make a movie like Selma. But I found myself more engaged with learning about SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and these just this central dilemma of how the black experience should respond to the prejudice and violence upon them. You know, the same sort of, you know, Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X, integration versus separation and militancy. And, you know, that's a debate. That's a movie that has a debate.
Just a quick liner here, though. For those who have not seen it, Selma focuses on 3 months in 1965. When Martin Luther King was pushing the passage of voter rights legislation during the Johnson administration.
Yes.
So like the Lincoln movie, it's really about this short period of time.
Exactly.
Right.
It's not a biopic.
Good comparison. Yeah,
whereas,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, I did my homework before I came. Whereas American Sniper is, let's go back to Chris Kyle as a little boy, right? Davy Crockett killed a bar in 18-aught something. You know, he was a little boy. He hunted. It's the story of him. And I don't feel like the movie is having that strong debate as much as it's celebrating this guy. And it's, you know, people are having complex reactions to it. It's disturbing to see stories in the media of people being given death threats, you know, like Michael Moore and Seth Rogen, you know, if they complain about the movie, people attack them and say, you know, Clint Eastwood should come to your house and shoot you or something.
Wow.
There was some story about Clint Eastwood threatening to kill Michael Moore that has come out recently.
I missed that one.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
You can Google it. But it's ironic to me to hear stories of people giving death threats to American citizens who use their First Amendment rights to comment about a movie that they find troubling. You know, you should not feel frightened to say, yeah, of course we support the troops and individual people, but the way they are depicted in art is problematic and not an easy process and not always.
And that does get back to the question I brought up, too, I guess. Are we going in there to get a history lesson?
Right.
Or do we want to see just a good picture that entertains, which ultimately that does. And by the way, I've taken just a little poll with people who've seen the movie. And I don't know if you had the same experience when you were walking out of the film after the credits were coming down.
Pure silence.
Unlike any of the other of the eight films that I saw for Best Picture, all of them very moving and very well done. But it even lasted into the parking lot where people were just still. And this seems to be, at least in the little poll I had, talking to my sister who saw it in Albuquerque, New Mexico, same experience. So, you know, you're numb afterwards. And so the film has provoked a lot of discussion. And, you know, that's another goal of cinema as well.
Yeah.
For there to be a dialogue about good art or art that will capture our attention.
Let me say these things about it. I do think that it's clearly going to be a movie, a touchstone movie that gets talked about and remembered. And it gets this historical status because it, in some ways, it's almost the Gone Girl that I was talking about. It is by far the most financially successful of all of the nominated films.
Oh, yeah.
And I think a lot of people are now going to tune into the Oscars on Sunday specifically to see if this important American movie, American Sniper, is going to get awards. You know, certain movies pull in that audience, and that's what the Oscars are interested in. The show that we are discussing, this idealized, respectable program of celebrating art, is a business entity for a TV show so that more people watch it and you can charge more for ad revenues so the Academy can make more money and do what they will with it, which isn't necessarily bad. It's supporting their museums and their fundraisers, but it is still this business, and it's wise of them to, it's very fortunate for them that we have this movie that is a huge hit, and it's a huge hit that is a drama about real people. And if you look at the other movies in the box office that successful, they are comic book, superhero, fantasy sequels, etc. But I want to go back to, so there you go. I've said some nice things about American Sniper. But to go back to your point, see how worked up I am. This is a particularly passionate one for me. You mentioned some movies should give you a history and some movies should just give you a good entertaining time. That's fine. Good entertaining times are great, but that doesn't make them one of the best eight pictures of the year. There are lots
and
of
that's
good
a good point.
That's right.
A good point.
You can enjoy it. You can say, I got it. Right. I got a satisfying time. You know, I got satisfying times at movies with heroes called James Bond that are very ideologically problematic and not complicated. But I don't go telling people that Octopussy was the best picture of 1983. I say I had a, I didn't learn anything. You know, that movie gave me a satisfying fantasy of being a man, having a gun, and setting the world to rights. That's fine, right? But that doesn't make it one of the eight best pictures of the year. And so I'm very curious to see how this gets talked about in the future. And as you said, should it be a history lesson? It's not history lesson. It's present. It's about something that's still so raw and present. It's almost impossible for it to be what those other Clint Eastwood films were, which were about the Old West and World War II. It's very difficult to map that stuff where we've all collectively decided so much about it onto the present where it's still so raw. And I think you see that in these debates around it, where people are so angry one way or the other that we're trying to historicize and use cowboy iconography on the present. And for some people, that's very satisfying and soothing that that cowboy stuff is always there and never will leave America. And for other people, that's offensive to say that is so simple-minded and to try and apply that to the morass. Look at how much worse the Middle East is. And maybe it's because of all this cowboy yahooism. Those are very big questions that I think get brushed aside for the sake of an entertaining, suspenseful, well-made, gripping movie about a guy, about one important, about one special guy.
Right, right. So, and it does let you into a little bit about the SEAL community and what they go through as well. So, you know, I mean, by the way, should we go on to some other films too, or did you want to say one or two more things about American Sniper?
No, I think I need to. I think that's the hour, everybody. Thank you. Try to make time for the others because I've got lots of complaints about those too.
Okay.
Selma,
well, we were just talking about Selma.
Yeah.
Some wonderful performances in Selma. And David Oyelowo, the actor who portrayed King, very believable. And what did you want to say? Anything else about Selma?
Yeah, well, we were talking also about the portrayal of LBJ in the movie.
Right, exactly.
And so there's that controversy as well. And so that, you know, that's something that comes up. You know, you frame this discussion as some of these movies engage with reality. And so it's fair game to say, how well are they doing? Let's have a conversation with them. Let's watch them and decide, are they telling the full story? Are they manipulative? Are they leaving things out? How do we feel? The movie isn't just the movie. The movie is part of our culture, and we discuss it. And so I think that with Selma, we get to discuss how LBJ is portrayed. I don't think it's that problematic. For me, since the movie is from Martin Luther King's point of view, to backtrack.
That's a good point, too.
Thank you. For listeners, the controversy is, LBJ has a legacy of the Great Society, the Civil Rights Act, and in many ways this legacy is an American president who did some wonderful progressive things and then had his reputation dismantled by the Vietnam War. And after the movie Selma was released, a former aide of President Johnson said, this movie is portraying him as too obstructionist for black advancement and black rights.
Well, it comes across as a villain.
Right, right.
Essentially, right.
I think even that...
And he was working with King, or at least that's what the history books would lead you to believe.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think Governor George Wallace of Alabama is the villain.
Boy, no kidding, huh?
The movie makes that clear and history makes it clear. LBJ repeatedly says, look, I'm a politician. I've got 1,000 things on my plate. You're Martin Luther King. You have this one central issue, and we are very different. And I think that's fair. And I think if you're telling a movie from Martin Luther King's perspective, then of course LBJ is going to seem obstructionist to Martin Luther King. It makes you feel how Martin Luther King felt in these conversations. If the movie was called LBJ, then Martin Luther King might seem more of a conflicting figure, saying, oh gosh, he's presenting conflict and obstacle, whereas LBJ is trying to fight poverty, as he puts it, that there are these other issues. And of course, class and poverty impact racial issues all the time. So it's fair. If there hadn't been a controversy, I don't know that I would have thought that there was one there in the depiction of LBJ.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You know, interesting, British actors portraying Coretta
Roth.
King and also...
Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Tom Wilkinson.
He's a British actor. So, which is interesting to me.
Well, it's funny because
it's a very American issue.
Yeah. We talked about, it's funny the ways in which these things get talked about, because Selma is being talked about for its lack of nominations, you know, and I would say, I think Selma is the better movie to American Sniper. I think it is stronger, more thoughtful. It's stronger, more thoughtful, and it's more moving. It's the only one of the eight nominated films for Best Picture that made me cry. Just watching the footage at the end of all the people attending this speech and then the little updates of where they were. This woman was killed by protesters 2 weeks after this speech. You know,
Very powerful. You're right.
Yeah, it's so moving. Oyelowo was doing such a great job. And then to see this, it's so moving. And so people were upset saying, you know, look at the racism of the Oscars. That David Oyelowo is not getting nominated. It's a very white body of acting nominations. And then Oyelowo himself says, well, I actually had to come to America in order to have my career as a leading man because Britain wouldn't let me. Britain is so white. Britain's movies are so period piece, Pride and Prejudice, etc., heritage cinema, that there aren't that many roles. So ironically, for him, it's progress to come to America and get the part at all and be seen. And I think like Chiwetel Ejiofor, he's three or four pictures away from getting that nomination. So there's that conflict. You know, some people say, gosh, Ava DuVernay was not nominated for Best Director. And so that's a reminder. Yeah, it's not just the racism of the Academy. It's not about racism.
What's her background?
Her background is... industry, which surprises me. She's done public relations work. She's done promotional work for major studio films, and she's made short films, other features that have played independent festivals, Sundance, etc.
This was quite a leap for her to direct Selma.
Yeah, and I feel like she's being snubbed because she's not an auteur. I think if it was a well-known, established white male auteur, I think if this was Steven Spielberg's Selma, it would get more promotional push. It would have been had more faith in it, because it's just as vital, just as energetic, just as intelligent, just as well made as Lincoln. It's got another strong central performance. And yet the studio system, the industry, again, as I was saying, it could be racism, it could be sexism, it could just be the way we do business is we reward the people that have been doing business, and Ava DuVernay hasn't been doing business with us as long, so we're not going to reward her yet. They may be embarrassed by it and correct that in the future, but I think at the end of the day, yes, race is caught up in it, gender is caught up in it, but it's money. The Oscars are about an industry celebrating this industry, and of course they're going to try to reward their way while also paying lip service to other people. So,
well, I tell you what, let's talk about those two others you brought up that you said, The Imitation Game, mm-hmm. and also The Theory of Everything. Why see both of them? Because they're basically British actors,
yes.
British scientists, mathematicians. Why go see both of them? And what was the reasoning for that?
Oh, well, for me, it was an absolutely personal decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the ways in which we frame these conversations is, you know, Chris, you have this background of study. What do you recommend? What you tell people what they should see? And I don't...
Or suggestions.
Exactly.
I like that word. It's a little softer.
Right. Yeah. You know. You know how I get. I get worked up. This is the most worked up I've been on this show. I made a choice for myself to seek out some of the foreign films. At the expense of the foreign language films, I should say, at the expense of The Theory of Everything, because I program that series at CLC, because I'm always looking, and they are really strong this year. Ida is great.
You saw Leviathan too.
Leviathan is wonderful.
Right,
the Russian film. The others are just starting to open in Chicago, so I'm
Here's the problem, though. I can go to a Cineplex.
Right.
And fortunately, I can see The Theory of Everything. And I say fortunately because sometimes you have to go to an art house to see that.
But exactly.
That's, you know, at the Regal Theater or wherever, AMC. The international films you're talking about are very difficult to find or locate.
Well, that's part of the reason why I'm going to see them is because technically, effectively, I'm kind of the third run. That if I find them and like them and I can get a good price for them, then I will show them at CLC and local Lake County residents can go see them on a big screen. And, you know, I can promote, you know, Leviathan.
Well, let's plug that event right now. When is that going to be?
Okay. Well, there are three more this semester. Thank you for helping me plug them. The next one is called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. It's from Turkey. That's not on the ballot. That is a movie that won prizes at the Cannes Film Festival a couple of years ago. And then that's the first Friday of March. Then the first Friday of April, the first Friday of May, we'll have a couple of more foreign films. And you can go to the CLC website or go to Facebook and look for CLC International Film Series. But right now I'm trying to pick the fall movies that I will be showing. And if I can get good prices for Leviathan and Ida and 2 Days, One Night and check out some of those others, I will be an avenue for people to see those on a big screen. So that's realistically, that's why I didn't go see The Theory of Everything, because I'm trying to make time for myself as an exhibitor.
And there are just too many films to see.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But you did see The Imitation Game.
Yes.
Before we take a break, what were your thoughts about that?
I had problems with it, too. I am such a downer. We are going to get the films that I like.
I started off this show saying, what a wonderful crop.
I know.
And each one, you're just kind of, go ahead.
I think we're having a perfectly wonderful conversation about these movies.
Yeah.
I think the process of participating in your culture and talking about them is good.
Exactly.
I think for me, the
Imitation Game,
thank you.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is Alan Turing.
Yes, Alan Turing, the...
Right.
The
cracked the Nazi Enigma code.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's an example for me of a movie that is being praised for its subject matter a little bit more than the actual quality of the movie.
Well, it's almost like he's getting recognition now.
Right.
Instead of, it was such a secrecy, the task that they had to do to crack this code. And now here we are after his death.
Yeah,
he's starting to get the recognition that he deserves.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have some family in Britain, and as a result, I guess, of some of that background, I have heard this story before.
Mm-hmm.
They made a film called Enigma a few years ago with Kate Winslet.
Again, after his death, though, I guess is what I'm.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But still, that story was a little bit better, better known for British citizens, I guess. There have been. You know, there's even a Doctor Who story in the 80s that tells a version of the story that also has underwater vampires coming after the code machine. But it's maybe a newer story in America, this fascinating guy. But to me, it's certainly not dull, and Benedict Cumberbatch is charming. He's a little bit of the It boy at the moment, thanks to that Sherlock show. But to me, it's another great man movie. It's another movie about here is this individual figure, this pivotal figure, and he changed history entirely because of him. World War II was won. And given how complicated he was, and given how complicated his mind was, given how complicated his machine was, complications of solving the code, I felt like I wanted a movie that was more complicated, that would teach me more things, that would be more intellectually stimulating. If you watch the movie, it's almost luck that this genius figures out the way to finally crack the code. Someone makes an offhand comment in a cafeteria, and thanks to that, oh gosh, you're right, you've given me the clue. And we think, so was it complete luck that we're not all speaking German today?
But that could be Hollywood for all we know.
Well, it makes
a good story, you know?
But then, therefore, if we're simplifying it to that degree, does it make it one of the 8 best pictures of the year, right? Whereas it might be more special and more critically valuable to do something a bit more complicated rather than reduce it to a Hollywood formula.
Tell you what, we have to take a break, Chris.
I need to lie down.
No. This is just wonderful to have you here. It really is. It's just
Thank you. Good
fun. I'm talking to Chris Cooling, film professor at the College of Lake County. And when we come back, we'll see how much time we got, actually. Like to continue our conversation here with Chris regarding the Oscars, including Best Actor, Best Actress, and we'll look at more of those Best Pictures. Please don't go away. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and I'm talking to Chris Cooling, film professor at the College of Lake County. And in the background, you hear the Oscar-nominated song Glory from the film Selma. And I tell you, that one by John Legend and Common, that's the one that apparently is the favorite right now, Chris.
Yeah, that's the We Apologize to the Movie Selma Award that we gave you so few nominations, and we'll try to be better in future, I think. But it's also a great song that deserves the award.
It only really came up with one or two nominations, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Song and picture. No Oyelowo, no DuVernay. And again, given the caliber, it seems like the sort of movie. But you're always going to have problems like that when you go from eight nominations to five spots for everything else.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, like we said, that's John Legend and Common, Glory, wonderful song up for Best Song. We'll be able to watch that on... imagine it'll be performed by them on Sunday night. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Oscars. And Chris is an old friend of the program, film professor at the College of Lake County. And, you know, we really just got so far talking about Best Picture, but I'd like to continue our discussion. We focused a lot of time, if you're just joining us, on American Sniper and Selma. Talked a little bit about the two British films, and we can come back to the theory of everything, but let's get to Birdman, because I want to make sure we have time for that, the Michael Keaton vehicle. Your thoughts, your observations, and they're saying that that's a favorite along with Boyhood, which we can talk about as well, but Birdman.
Yeah, well, it seems like the race is down to Birdman versus Boyhood, and people are predicting that there might be a split between one of them getting Best Picture and one of them getting Best Director. But I was thinking about them, and you mentioned, you know, framing the show in terms of these first four are based on real people, and then these others are based on fictional characters. Birdman and Grand Budapest Hotel and Whiplash aren't just about made-up characters. They're also about making things up. They're about show business. They're about performance. They're about artistry, whether it's the artistry of theater and filmmaking and acting in Birdman, or the artistry of drumming and performance in Whiplash, or the artistry of everything in the Grand Budapest Hotel. Making a beautiful pastry is crucial to the plot that the Nazis refuse to cut into. So it is an interesting other theme that the Oscars like to celebrate truth and reflections of history and how well we can do that. But then we get movies that pay tribute to showmanship and virtuosity, and Birdman in many ways is almost nothing but that. And so some people... revel in it. They lose themselves in Birdman's joy of creation and energy. And some
we
people
should probably give a liner here for those who have not seen Birdman. Well, it's a real time unbroken shots.
Right.
That's how it's shot, which is very interesting. And it's a comedy drama, a dramedy, I would say.
Sure.
Is about a former star trying to make a comeback on Broadway, featuring Michael Keaton, who many have said this is his comeback movie.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
So that's a little bit of the liner. If you've not seen Birdman, I highly recommend it, along with the other seven. Go ahead.
I mean, I recommend to see it. I may have been slightly disappointed. Let me just say, I know.
Oh, boy.
Let's put it like this, Jim.
I'm coming across as a Pollyanna.
No. Yeah. We're going to build to a climax where you can finally say at the end of the show, well, what the heck do you like? What's good enough for you? And I will defend Whiplash with a passion. I will say that would be my no-brainer pick.
Okay,
for
we're going to take a little bit of a detour.
Yeah. That's foreshadowing.
Hopefully we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Birdman.
All right. So have you ever seen a movie called 8 and a Half?
Yes.
How well do you remember it?
Vaguely, film class when I was in college.
Film studies
in
101.
The 70s.
Well, for me, it was the 90s when I saw it, but it was a definitive film, and I just showed it a couple weeks ago. When I saw Birdman, I thought, you know, it was cute. It's well made. I thought Michael Keaton was great. Edward Norton in particular was great.
He's always good.
Yeah, and that if it wasn't for Whiplash and J.K. Simmons, he would be getting that Best Supporting Actor, but it's going to go to J.K. Simmons. That I thought to myself when I watched Birdman, oh, I get it. This is a high-tech remake of 8 and a Half, a movie about an artist trying to deal with middle age, trying to deal with his family, trying to make a comeback, and the joy of realizing the movie you are watching is itself the beautiful creative project that replenishes and re-energizes that aging artist. That in 8 and a Half, the filmmaker character, Marcello Mastroianni's character, is trying to make this science fiction film, but he realizes he'd rather make the movie we are watching about an Italian man struggling with affairs, struggling with the church, struggling with his memories. And Birdman is like that as well. We've got someone who's ostensibly making this theatrical adaptation of a Raymond Carver story, but really the joy is the process itself, the process of running around the theater, getting locked out, running around in your underwear in Times Square. So, you know, it's very joyous. Michael Keaton is
and
great.
And rat-a-tat dialogue.
Rat-a-tat dialogue and rat-a-tat music that, to me, I found a little bit monotonous and literal-minded. There was some controversy over whether that score should be nominated, the drum improvising score. And, you know, it's pleasant.
Well, it was kind of Hitchcockian, wasn't it? Kind of scraping your nerves a little bit and keeping you on edge.
I would agree with that, actually. Yeah. And for me, the reference point would be Bernard Herrmann's not music for The Birds. I wonder if that is sound design. I don't know if Herman was, I think Bernard Herrmann was involved, you know, so he does the screeching music for Psycho, but for The Birds, there's no music except for bird noises. Mm-hmm. And again, that's a very bold, risky choice that either pays off or you find abrasive. And in Birdman, I found it, I guess I said, a little bit monotonous where I said, I get it. It's improvising. It's jazzy. It's frantic, just like the movie.
He also honored Hitchcock with the shots, too.
The long take, yeah.
The long take being blurring, done with rope with Jimmy Stewart.
Invisibly blurred into one another, right? Yeah, it's not it's not literally one long shot, but it's meant to feel
right.
And so, again, there's that sense of virtuosity. The characters are virtuosos, and the movie is itself. And as a result, the movie seems to be not much more than a championing of artworks like that. It is a movie that suggests more movies like Birdman should be made.
I get back though, Chris. Okay. Sorry to interrupt, but
I'm all over the map.
That's what's fun. And then what happens? I'd mentioned that in the first segment. If a movie's doing that like it does in American Sniper, where you're on edge wondering what's going to happen to this character, I felt that way with Michael Keaton in Birdman. I mean, there was so much suspense in that comedy drama that I think it was accomplishing its a goal for me anyway, and for others I've talked to.
Well, so what is the suspense for you, that you're worried that either he will succeed or fail?
Yes. There's a lot on the line.
Right. I guess for me, as someone interpreting the movie, I felt like I figured out that its mission statement was... You know, it doesn't matter. It's this creative process. It's he has succeeded because he is living fully in the process of making this energetic work of art, much like the movie Birdman.
But weren't you excited to see that? How would Ed Norton, how would he interplay with Michael Keaton? What would the dialogue be next?
Anytime he shows up. And what I most love about it is Edward Norton's character and performance, because in many ways, he's taking a very easy stock role. In many ways, Birdman is a familiar movie, a backstage theater. We've seen movies about people from the theater that have big egos, don't you know? And Edward Norton is playing that. But what I just did was a terrible cliche, whereas Edward Norton breathes great life into it, because sometimes he's right. Sometimes you listen to that character and you think, that is making the play better. That crazy idea that this insane, obsessive character has suggested is actually brilliant. And he's the most complicated and fascinating thing in it to me, that he is doing two things at once. He is the genuine suspense for me, whereas everything else was this, to me, a kind of entertaining and, yes, spectacular monotony, ongoing drumming and camera movement and blurring. Michael Keaton gets some of it when he gets to pretend that he's really upset. He has a scene where he acts in front of Edward Norton and then reveals that he has been acting. That is also quite stupendous. But for me, the depiction of the critic in the movie, that there is, you know, you mentioned there is this suspense. I think it's a straw man argument that there is this evil critic that can't wait to take him down. I don't think that's very dramatically realistic. I don't think that's very dramatically convincing. I think it's a fake villain. And without it, I don't really find that suspense. I get the joy and pleasure and buzz from it, but not that sense of the debate and conflict. That is central to Whiplash.
Well, I tell you what, let's segue to Whiplash, because you apparently like that movie quite a bit.
Yes.
And wonderful performance, as you said. So the quick liner is personal story about a young drummer who wants to be the next Buddy Rich in his relationship with his music teacher, the tyrannical and abusive Terrence Fletcher.
I adored this movie, and it had a great reputation coming out of the Sundance Festival and I think the Toronto Film Festival as well. And I think it's almost unfair that the praise is being so centered around J.K. Simmons, that the movie is going – he is going to win. That's one of those every gambler knows, don't bet against J.K. Simmons Sunday night. But the movie itself is so good. It is tight like a diamond. It has no fat on it, and – It is very, as you say, edge of your seat. It's experiential. You feel like you are this kid. You feel like you're lost. Those performance sequences of playing the drums are to me are more riveting than anything in American Sniper. And who would have thunk it that playing drums on a stage would be more gripping than holding a gun in Iraq? But I think hands down, that is the case with Whiplash. Those are more suspenseful. And it has the force of a debate. It has a central conflict. Is this mentor character right or wrong? Just like we had with Edward Norton. Is this a crazy person, or is Edward Norton actually helping the theatrical production with his ideas?
Well, and I mean, he's an abusive teacher,
right?
Not only just mentally, but physically.
Yeah, yeah.
He literally slaps him.
Slaps people, throws cymbals at
chairs,
people.
Chairs, everything, right. Yeah.
But the movie presents this argument suggesting, is that the path to greatness? And the character will say this, like, I'm pushing you, I'm doing all these things in order to create the art, and art needs me to be this much of a villain in order to push you as far as you can. And there is this central conflict there of, maybe, you know, is he right? We hate him, he's a villain, but is that really the path to creating something great? That struggle, that conflict, that stress? And sometimes we fall for that and we believe in it. And I think that movie resolves the debate. Part of why I like it is I'm having that debate too while I watch it. It's visceral. It's a good time at the theaters, but it's also intellectually stimulating, this debate about how we should, inspire and push people. And I think I watch the film and I say to myself, if that guy wants to take credit for the really wonderful jazz musicians he's produced, he also has to take credit for the ones that he's destroyed in the process.
Oh, absolutely.
You are responsible in both directions. And to me, that's devastating. To me, that's a real moral conundrum that the movie is, getting at the heart of, whereas Birdman is flying off in, no pun intended, thank you, in so many directions. I'm proud of that one. That it doesn't have that same central force, whereas just Whiplash, I think, Whiplash, and to me, even Foxcatcher, which we won't have time to talk about, I guess.
But, we can talk about that, even though it's not one of the nominees.
Yeah. They're movies that that Stanley Kubrick would have been proud of. They're really, really rigorous and precise, both of them.
Clockwork Orange and...
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah,
I mean, that's not my... A lot of people have made that connection, Full Metal Jacket to Whiplash. But it's not just the performance. It's that rigor and precision.
Well, he said something interesting, too, though. The two deadliest words, this is the character from Whiplash,
right,
are in the English language, are good job.
Yeah. And you know what?
I got kind of a little, that's interesting.
Well, let me say this. I thought the people who made The Imitation Game did a good job. Clint Eastwood did a good job making American Sniper.
But oh, boy.
Good is the enemy of great. They're all movies that are entertaining, you won't hate yourself if you see them, but they're so interesting, they should have been better. And Whiplash cannot be improved. There's no room to improve it. It is perfect. And I would have no hesitation voting for it. It will not win because it doesn't have the money behind it, etc. And it's so easy to give the award to J.K. Simmons and say, that's it. You deserve that and nothing else. But it's the best of the eight pictures.
And if anything, it'll make you go get your Buddy Rich records out and give it a listen. That's for sure.
I keep pinching myself that I haven't bought that soundtrack yet. I will, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of good points there. We haven't talked about Boyhood yet.
Well,
we talked a lot about it last fall,
time.
But yeah. We could have new listeners here joining us.
Sure.
So you liked Whiplash, apparently. So it sounds to me Boyhood has come down a little bit in your poll, I would say.
I think.
Or rating.
Well, let me come around this way. My friend Noah and I from grad school used to have this ongoing conversation. And the conversation was this. Which great directors will one day win Best Director for a specific movie? Or I should say versus get a Lifetime Achievement Award for their body of work. So, for example, Tim Burton, hypothetically, is a singular filmmaker, very, very special. But I don't think he's ever going to make the best film of the year in the eyes of the Academy.
And that's how I feel about Wes Anderson.
Exactly. Wes Anderson, one day, is so unique. One day they'll give him the Lifetime Achievement Award, and they will for Tim Burton.
Because the Grand Budapest Hotel,
yeah,
you mentioned before, is a piece of art, a pastry. I mean, it's something else.
Right. It's a concoction.
Savored.
Right.
Yeah.
So his style is unique, but I don't know that he's going to get Best Director. I think Richard Linklater is someone who deserves this award for this movie, but also his body of work. Richard Linklater is someone where, if he doesn't get it, if they give it to Alejandro González Iñárritu for Birdman, then Richard Linklater will get this Lifetime Achievement Award eventually. Mm-hmm. But his body of work, those Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, Before Midnight, even Bernie, so many of his movies, Dazed and Confused is a beloved movie.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to get this award both for how great Boyhood is, but also for the movies that he's been making during those 12 years. That in many ways, that movie is a document of that young man's upbringing, but it's also about the maturation of Richard Linklater over the years, that he's gone from someone making small movies in Austin for an art house independent crowd to someone who has brought this style into the mainstream, and we've seen his influence. I will have no problem watching him win either picture or director or both on Sunday night.
That film has staying power. Now, it was released in the summer.
Yes.
Unlike these other films that came out later,
mm-hmm.
Though the Grand Budapest Hotel didn't come out
earlier
too.
Yeah,
you're right. Yeah. But Boyhood, it's got legs.
Yeah.
And now it's the DVD sales have been extraordinary too.
Well, so the problem with that is that those legs have allowed people to give voice to the backlash for it. And I kind of thought that it would be inevitable that for some people, they would see it as too slight, too slow. Some people say, like Birdman, it's built around a gimmick. That Birdman has the gimmick of the real-time shots, and Boyhood has the gimmick of real time. You know, the gimmick of actually making the movie over 12 years. And there are some voices, they're always going to be complaining about the movie because the voices want some other movie to win. You know, people will always attack one movie over the other. Because Harvey Weinstein has paid them to, most likely. And so there is this little backlash saying, Boyhood is so slight. Boyhood doesn't seem like it has much of a story. And in many ways, you know, you sent me an article about it saying, no, that's precisely the point. And what makes it so special is that it has the weight of time and the qualities of real life, that it has a record of reality. And for a lot of people, that is what cinema should do rather than rivet you to your seat or give you a Hollywood polish or give you, you know, an escape. It should capture reality. And
so we've been actually, we started the program talking about suggestions / predictions.
Yes.
And I think, spent most of the time on suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
Your prediction then, even though it sounds like Whiplash is your favorite film of the eight that we've talked about, we barely talked about The Theory of Everything, which, by the way, has wonderful performances in it.
I've heard that.
The movie about Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
His struggle with ALS And it's a very inspiring story.
They say Eddie Redmayne has a chance to sneak away with it.
Yeah,
I mean, so I should see it.
Tremendous performance. So of the eight that we have discussed, some in a great length, some not so much.
Yeah.
It sounds like Whiplash is the one that you enjoyed the most. But in terms of the predictions, Birdman or Boyhood?
Or Boyhood? I mean, you know, if you ask me personally, it's simply a too close to call at this point. I would say, and it's not just me saying it, a lot of people have thought it could split either direction on Oscar night, that one of them gets Best Picture and one of them gets Best Director. So either way, if you're gambling, you know, if you're having an Oscar pool, lower it down to one of those in the Best Picture and Best Director races, Boyhood and Birdman. Because people, what do? They look at history, they look at previous award winners, they say, what has won at the Screen Actors Guild Awards? What has won at the BAFTAs? What has won at the Directors Guild? And so some people look at the tea leaves and say,
handicap it, right.
Exactly. Right, yeah. Because of these, it must be Boyhood. Because of these, it must be Birdman. And I'm no more knowledgeable than anyone else about the potential for upsets or predictions. You know, it does seem to be that it's going to lower down to one of those two.
But you do have very strong feelings about American Sniper, which we discussed in a segment one.
That yes.
That was really, really interesting. Hey, Chris, one thing that we talked a little bit about snubs. I was surprised, you know, being from Chicago, I would even say the word astonished, that Life itself, the film based on Roger Ebert's memoir, wasn't nominated in the documentary category. It's not a big category, I realize, but just to honor him, I was a little dismayed by that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly here in Illinois, that's going to smart more than it does in Hollywood. But the documentary category has had a rich, wonderful history. In many ways, Roger Ebert himself would probably be honored to join that category of great documentaries snubbed by the Academy. In some ways, that's actually the more prestigious list. He gets to join Steve James's previous masterpiece of documentary, Hoop Dreams, as a movie that seemed like a no-brainer and yet was not, I don't think it was even nominated.
Wasn't nominated.
Yeah.
Was geez. Not nominated. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's, they have their own philosophy over there within the documentary nominations. Those people, they like to champion something that wouldn't otherwise be seen. They like to say, okay, well, everybody that saw Life itself has seen it, would have gone to see it, and that movie doesn't need our help. Let us support these other smaller films, these other documentaries. You know, documentary in general is such a struggling art form. You know, we have so much reality TV, so much artificial news. You know, look at Brian Williams. The process of making documentaries is so fraught, so fragile, that I don't know that it always has to be, let's give the award to the movie that is already really big and popular and well-known. Maybe we should try to find those smaller ones. And so there's just a different sense of curation behind the documentary categories, that these people would rather find something for you that you've never heard of and make you hear of it, as opposed to let's all pat something on the back that already is getting lots of attention.
Before we go, we did tease at the break. We were going to talk about Best Actor and Best Actress. We did talk about Best Actor, I think, to a certain degree. You just were talking about Eddie Redmayne's
versus
performance.
Michael Keaton.
And Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
Best Actress, though, I think we should touch on it. Still Alice and Julianne Moore. Just a terrific performance.
And the beauty of it is it's her time. She's been I'm certain she will, and it's overdue. And it's one of those awards that will be, let's give it to this person for their body of work, because I don't think the movie itself is getting great reviews. I still haven't had a chance to see it, but everyone has said that she's the whole show. Even if the movie is not perfect, she is incredible in it. And so there's a little bit of, gosh, can you believe that Paul Newman won for The Color of Money? Paul Newman is great, but who's seen The Color of Money lately? Can you believe that Al Pacino won for Scent of a Woman? He's great, and Scent of a Woman is fun, but, you know, people watch a lot of other Al Pacino movies more often than they go revisit that. And I think there's something going on here where this is the time to say Julianne Moore has been doing so much good for so long that she will walk away with it.
One last thing. Any film that's off the radar, the Oscar radar completely, that you've seen that you would recommend?
Off the radar completely?
Or just a little bit.
You know, last time I wanted to champion a movie called The Guest, which was an absolute piece of pop joy that it was. It, to me, it was riveting. It was pure entertainment. It was a great Hollywood style movie, but it was made independently. It was a wonderful thriller. And that's the type of movie where I do. I don't just suggest it. I recommend. I recommend you track down this little movie. You don't learn anything about the premise and sit down and enjoy it and let it surprise you and say, gosh, why don't they make them like that anymore? That had such great thrills and story and surprises and craft, and no one went to see it. And we didn't have time for me to champion it. It's out on Blu-ray now, and it's the type of thing that would never be getting Oscar attention. And yet, when you make it to 10 nominations, you know, you should say, Hollywood also does great pulp, great thrills, great adventure, great suspense, and those movies should sneak in there as well. So check out The Guest if you're going to throw something in there.
Chris Cooling, always wonderful to have you on the show.
I need to go lie down now.
Tell you what, I have got to be a student in one of your classes one of these times. I tell you, Chris Cooling, film professor from the College of Lake County. Again, thank you for dropping by word of mouth.
Always a joy.
I tell you what, if you'd like to visit or contact Chris Cooling, you can go to the CLC website, www.clcillinois.edu. And thank you for tuning in. I hope to drop by again next Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.